headlines this hour. The Yemeni army says it has shot down a U.S. drone over Ma'ari province, the sixth such spy plane downed in Yemen this year. The United Nations warns of a deteriorating humanitarian crisis in Africa's Sahel region due to activities of terror groups. And the World Health Organization says that Europe has recently witnessed a record weekly rise in its coronavirus cases. Well, welcome to our studio here in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. The Yemeni army says it has shot down a U.S. spy drone over its Ma'ari province, a key region witnessing fighting for months now. Army spokesman Yahya Sari says that the drone was of Scan Eagle type. He says that it was the sixth U.S. spy drone shot down by Yemeni forces this year. The announcement comes as the Yemeni army continues fighting with Saudi-backed former regime loyalists to liberate Ma'ari. The army has in recent weeks made significant gains. Meanwhile, the leader of Al-Qaeda's branch in Yemen has confirmed that his terrorists have fought alongside Saudi-led mercenaries there. Saeed Batarfi says that the battles have taken place on 11 fronts. Saudi Arabia denies such cooperation. Earlier we talked to Yemeni political commentator Hossein Abu-Qaiti. He says that the army, by downing the U.S. drone, has cut Saudi's access to information needed for airstrikes on Ma'arib and elsewhere.
We have seen from the beginning of the war that the Saudi-led coalition depend like 100% on U.S. drone and as well on Saudi drone to collect information about area they will target, and they could at the beginning of the war conduct hundreds of airstrikes in the latest advance toward Ma'arib. Ma'arib is most of Ma'arib and Al-Jawf province north of Yemen is a desert, so it should be easy for the Saudi airstrike to target Yemeni forces in that area. But actually, it was totally the opposite, that because Yemeni army have upgraded their air defense missile, they have taken down almost all Saudi and U.S. drones over the sky of Yemen, and this actually have cut one of the main information supplies that they used to depend to attack Yemeni forces.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. U.S. President Joe Biden says that there are sufficient supplies of petroleum worldwide so that other countries can cut their purchases from Iran. Biden made the remark in a memo to the State Department. That's part of a policy obliging the White House to affirm that every 6 months that there is enough oil supply worldwide to maintain sanctions against Iran. Those sanctions were imposed in 2012. They were later intensified after the U.S. withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal in 2018, making it hard for the country to freely sell its oil. The Islamic Republic says the sanctions are illegal. It's engaged in talks with the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal over the removal of those sanctions, with Tehran stressing that the removal should take place in a verifiable manner. Barry Grossman is an international lawyer who joins us from Bali. We also have Rodney Shakespeare, who is a professor of binary economics, joining us from London. I'd like to welcome you both. Barry Grossman, we know that what the U.S. President Joe Biden said is not true. I mean, there aren't enough oil supplies. There could be if OPEC ramped up its production, but there's not. So what purpose would this serve the U.S. other than to cut off Iran from revenues?
Well, look, I mean, I think the question of whether there's sufficient reserves for countries not to buy oil from Iran is almost beside the point. Clearly, the United States is using menaces to compel other countries to adopt U.S. policy vis-a-vis its approach to Iran. And the claim, of course, by the Biden administration and successive administrations before it, is that Iran has some kind of a nuclear program, which is a threat to the region and ostensibly illegal. That was made clear is not the case. In fact, as the JCPOA was being negotiated, the 17 agencies comprising the U.S. security apparatus had already in their confidential briefings to Congress each year, all individually conveyed the same position, which is Iran doesn't have a nuclear weapons program, has no plans to develop one, and if they were to develop one, would be caught out before a nuclear warhead could be made. So clearly, the aims of the administration after the Biden administration were not about Iran's nuclear program, which is perfectly legal. Unlike the nuclear program that we see in Israel, which is a weapons-grade program, which the world simply overlooks. So what we're really talking about is that the fact that the U.S. Has arrived at a position for whatever reason where it seeks to essentially compel Iran to either embrace U.S. hegemony or undergo what the Americans like to call regime change. And of course, that's not going to happen either. If the U.S. was genuinely concerned about the matters raised by President Biden, it would be really simple for the United States to simply return to the JCPOA. That, after all, is what the purpose of the JCPOA was. The fact that the Americans are not willing to embrace the very same treaty which they compelled Iran in many ways to negotiate tells us that these claims of being concerned about a nuclear program are simply an excuse. What we know is the United States wants to interfere with Iran's right to self-defense, its non-nuclear missile program, and a whole range of other internal matters which are uniquely within its own sovereign powers, not matters which the United States is entitled to dictate on. And we also know that the United States is prepared to do anything, including engage in piracy, in order to interfere with Iran's sale of oil, and in order to compel other countries to not purchase oil or much of anything else from Iran.
So how do you see the situation, Rodney Shakespeare, when you know, I mean, it's public knowledge that there's an energy crunch across the world, not only on gas, but also on oil. And Iran could also, well, can fill in that gap or that crunch that's existing there. The U.S. says, no, there's enough oil on the market. Is it to make OPEC, pressure OPEC into ramping up its production, and at the same time then cut off any revenues that Iran can make off of this?
American foreign policy is completely bankrupt. It is morally bankrupt. America's lost the moral leadership. It has lost the political leadership. It is actually no longer has the economic power. And it's getting this energy situation completely wrong. They are floundering as they try to create a new policy in a situation where their own policy is a mass of contradictions and is collapsing. The crux of this matter is that if America lifts sanctions, how can that be verified? And of course, nobody trusts the USA. But there is one way, and only one way, by which the USA can be trusted. And that is that the USA pays up the billions of dollars of economic damage that it has caused to Iran, that it pays up for the thousands of deaths caused by the medical sanctions, that it pays up to the family of General Qasem Soleimani damages for his assassination, and it makes a specific and public apology, and that the USA insists on its friends like the United Kingdom paying up what is now about £2 billion that the UK owes Iran, and then there are sums of money owed, for example, by South Korea. If the USA did that, then it could actually hold its head high and have some hope that it would be trusted again. But as things stand, nobody trusts the USA.
Quickly, if you can, Barry Grossman, you know, this is happening while there are these nuclear sanctions lifting talk. that's happening between the P4 plus one countries and Iran. On that note, do you think that what direction this is going to go? Do you think that anything will come out of it?
Well, I think the United States will continue to change the game anytime Iran tries to get close to doing a deal. The United States, and in particular the security apparatus, which essentially dictates foreign policy, is not interested in achieving an understanding with Iran. And any time the two nations get close to an understanding, the game changes. What is clear is that the United States will settle for nothing less than complete capitulation by Iran, which of course includes the insane aim of creating what they call regime change. That's simply not going to happen. The Islamic revolution is here to stay, whether the Americans like it or not. And they can continue to do what they're doing, which of course is causing great damage to Iran, but in an odd sort of a way, it's also making Iran stronger. To just touch on the question you put to both of us regarding Joe Biden's comments, look, it's to say there's enough oil available for countries not to buy from Iran is obviously premised on some idea about where demand should be. And demand is way down in many ways as a result of the pandemic. And now that we're seeing the global response to the pandemic shifting into having primary concern with global warming and the war on climate change, and in particular the war on carbon, there is, of course, a desire among Western nations and the corporations which essentially drive their economies to see reliance on conventional energy reduced. So this is a perfect time for them to try and push their point and compel other nations to make do with the oil that's available and not buy from Iran. Of course, it's simply not going to work.
Yeah, I mean, you opened up a topic that could be discussed a lot further. Unfortunately, we just don't have the time for this news review time slot. Thank you very much for that, Barry Grossman, international lawyer from Bali. And thank you, Rodney Shakespeare, professor of binary economics there from London. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. A senior Iraqi lawmaker says that he is confident that the last month's parliamentary election was rigged. Hadi al-Ameri heads the Fatah Alliance in Parliament. He believes voter fraud and irregularities took place by a cyber attack, likely involving Israel. He says some 3,600 electronic ballot machines stopped working during the elections and failed to send in results. Ameri said the confusion existing during the voting process indicated that Iraq's Electoral Commission was unable to hold a clean election. Dismissed as unacceptable the attack on demonstrators objecting to vote count results. The senior lawmaker also called for a probe into an attack on Prime Minister Mustafa al-Karimi's residence earlier this month. Iraq was for days the scene of protest rallies by supporters of political parties who lost the October 10 election. The UN says many lives are lost every day in Africa's Sahel region because of terrorist attacks there. The warning was made by the UN peacekeeping chief at a Security Council meeting. Jean-Pierre Lacroix says insecurity is hampering children's education, making primary health care inaccessible for many. He says millions of people have also been displaced at a time when COVID is raging in the African region. The UN officials said the joint force, formed by Chad, Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger, and Mauritania, continues its operations in Sahel. However, it faces major challenges and now risks losing all gains that it has made. Sahel is among the most volatile regions in Africa, hit by Daesh and al-Qaeda terrorists. Europe registered almost 2 million COVID cases in the first week of November, the highest figure in a single week there so far. That's according to the World Health Organization. The organization says during the same period, Europe logged almost 27,000 COVID fatalities. Again, a record number, accounting for more than half of all COVID deaths globally. The WHO says the disease is surging even in Western European countries, which have the world's highest vaccination rates. It says that's a reminder indicating vaccines do not replace the need for precautions to prevent transmission. Last week, the World Health Organization said that Europe has again become the epicenter of the disease, where all 53 countries are threatened by the virus surge. Countries like Russia, Hungary, and Poland, among others, have posted record daily numbers of infections and deaths in recent weeks. The United States has promised commitment to defending Japan, including a group of East China Sea islands disputed by Japan and China. The Japanese Foreign Minister Yoshimasa Hayashi says that his American counterpart, Antony Blinken, has assured him of the unwavering commitment in a phone call. Hayashi says the support also covers a group of Japan-administered islands in the East China Sea, which are a source of territorial dispute with China. The Japanese and American diplomats agreed to have cooperation on what they see as China's unilateral attempts to change the status quo in the East and South China Seas. That's in reference to China's artificial islands, which have put it at loggerheads with a group of regional countries. China says its activities pose no threat. New Zealanders again on the streets to oppose COVID restrictions and vaccinations in their country, this time in the city of Christchurch. The Saturday rally in Christchurch is the latest in protests across New Zealand in recent days. On Tuesday, thousands in the capital Wellington marched on Parliament to reject COVID restrictions. The government has adopted a tough response, including hard lockdowns and tight border restrictions. It comes after the largest city, Auckland, was hit by an outbreak of the Delta variant in mid-August. The city is still under stay-at-home orders. This week, Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said that the curbs would remain until the end of this month. New Zealand has logged 33 COVID deaths out of almost 8,500 cases since the start of the pandemic. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September 2nd, 2021. On the occasion of the National Government Week, President Raisi and the cabinet members met with Imam Khamenei in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya during the first days after the formation of the 30th administration.
On the nuclear issue, the US has truly passed all limits in their brazenness. There is no difference. Trump said it in one way, and the current administration says it in another way. We should pay attention to this. Behind the diplomatic scene, the US is truly a predatory wolf. In appearance, it is diplomacy. They smile, speak, and sometimes talk with self-righteousness. But in reality, they are a savage, vicious wolf that shows itself in many parts of the world. Of course, they sometimes appear in a wolf's clothing, and sometimes in a fox's clothing. They take on many forms. One manifestation of this today is the situation in Afghanistan. Afghanistan is our brother country, sharing the same language, religion, and culture. The crisis and sufferings in Afghanistan truly move an individual.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The incidents that are taking place one after another, the incidents that took place on Thursday at the Kabul airport, the killings, the problems, and the hardships they are going through are the US's doing. They occupied Afghanistan for 20 years and brought all sorts of oppression against the Afghan people. They bombarded their mourning ceremonies and their weddings. They killed their youth. They imprisoned many individuals without any reason in different prisons, and they increased the production of addictive drugs in Afghanistan by tens of times. They did all of these but refused to take one step to help develop Afghanistan. In other words, if today's Afghanistan, in terms of civil rights, construction, and other such developments, is not worse than those days, it is not better either. So, the US did nothing. Now that they are leaving, it is in such a disgraceful way.
And a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Mali's prime minister recently said he has evidence that France has been training terrorist groups operating in the West African country. The people of Mali have held several protests recently, saying enough is enough and demanding the withdrawal of French forces in the country. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today, which is focusing on the statement by Mali's prime minister to the effect that France is supporting terrorists in this West African country. The second segment of our program is focusing on how Canadian companies are plundering Africa's minerals. So stay tuned till the end of our show, and please keep your comments coming.
France training terrorists in Mali. France's relations with its former colony Mali has deteriorated since a coup in August 2020 toppled President Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta. Mali's Prime Minister Choguel Kokala Maiga has told the Russian media he has evidence that France has been training terrorist groups operating in the West African country. Maiga said French troops had created an enclave in Kidal, a town in the desert region of northern Mali, and handed it over to a terrorist group known as Ansar al-Din, allegedly linked to Al-Qaeda. He said the Malian military was blocked by French forces from entering the territory.
Addressing the 76th session of the UN General Assembly this year, Malian Prime Minister further accused France of failing to consult his country before withdrawing from a regional force that was combating terrorism.
Mali regrets the fact that the principle of consultation, which should be the rule between privileged partners, was not observed before the decision by the French government. The new situation resulting from the end of Operation Barkhane puts Mali before a fait accompli, abandoning us mid-fight to a certain extent, and it leads us to explore pathways and means to better ensure our security autonomously, or with other partners.
Well, to discuss Mali's assertion that France is supporting terrorist groups in this West African country, my colleague earlier contacted Daniel Lazar, a journalist and author. Now, we first asked Mr. Lazar if he is surprised that Mali is accusing France of supporting terrorist groups in the country, and this is what he had to say.
Not entirely. France, the trouble is that Mali is disintegrating, all kinds of conflicts are breaking out, and the French find themselves taking sides in various inter-ethnic conflicts, such as in support of the Tuaregs, for example. The Tuaregs have close relations, allegedly have close relations to Al-Qaeda. So it's very messy, and the French find themselves in alliances with forces they'd rather not be aligned with. So this is these kinds of confusions or difficulties often break out in these kinds of conflicts.
In June, France decided to scale back its Sahel deployment considerably following a military takeover in Mali in August 2020. Mali's prime minister stated that the government has no access to Kidal, the enclave controlled by France. He told Russia's RIA Novosti news agency that there are armed groups trained by French officers in the region. Why is France facing accusations of supporting the terrorists in Mali's Kidal region?
France has tried to form local alliances in order to facilitate its military effort. And when you form local alliances with local fighting groups, you often find yourself drawn into very complicated local wars. And then you find yourself on the side of people who you would rather not be on the side of. France is in a no-win situation. The situation in Mali is disintegrating rapidly. All kinds of ethnic conflicts are breaking out. France's presence can only make matters worse. It will not improve things. The fighting is spreading. The instability is spreading. And the French presence at this point is really more of an irritant than any kind of calming influence.
There have been reports that Mali plans to hire private security contractors from Russia to boost its own forces. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has dismissed accusations of Russian government involvement, saying that Kremlin had nothing to do with the deal, which was negotiated between Mali's government and a private military contractor.
Mali has approached Russian private military companies. We have nothing to do with that. This is an activity that has been carried out legitimately.
Mali, meanwhile, has received 4 helicopters, weapons and ammunition from Russia. Interim Defense Minister Sadio Camara had acquired the aircraft in a contract agreed in December 2020 to support his armed forces in their battle against terrorists. Camara said Russia is a reliable partner.
The extreme speed of execution of this contract shows the reliability and seriousness of this partner.
However, France and other European countries have been pressurizing Mali to halt its military ties with Russia. Mali is a sovereign country, so why do France and other European countries still behave like colonial powers and now demand that this country stop military cooperation with Russia?
Well, France is in no position to demand that Mali do anything, but France certainly has its troops there. It can withdraw its troops if it wants to, and can express unhappiness with any policy by the Mali government. Certainly, but for France can't go beyond, shouldn't go beyond that without affronting Mali's sovereignty. As I said before, the situation in Mali is very unsettled, very unstable. Charges are being lodged, you know, by all parties. Things are breaking down, and the French presence is only making matters worse. And whatever France, you know, and whatever France does at this point is going to cause greater and greater offense with the Malian government. So it's a bad situation for all concerned.
Now, early October, Mali summoned France's ambassador to register its indignation at French President Emmanuel Macron's criticism of the country's army-dominated government.
The French army should not fill the void of the non-functioning of the Malian state. That must be restored.
Now, the rising France-Mali tensions have raised questions over whether Paris is losing its grip on its former colony. We asked Mr. Lazard his opinion on the reported decline of France's influence in Mali.
I think we can say that, yes, that's quite true. I mean, first of all, the situation there is deteriorating. As I said before, France's presence is only making matters worse. France has less and less leverage, it's unable to really shape events in that part of the world to its liking. And the longer it stays there, the worse things seem to get. I mean, the fighting is spreading, the civil war is widening, and things are going downhill. So they're worse now than they were back in 2013 when France decided to insert itself into this conflict. But yes, its influence is definitely declining. But that's true for the U.S. influence and much of the world as well.
The U.N. Secretary General's Special Representative for West Africa and the Sahel told the Security Council in January this year that insecurity across the region had expanded into areas previously considered safe, with militants and terrorists continuing to stage deadly attacks.
Now, France and other Western countries have over the years claimed to be fighting terrorism in African countries such as Mali, but terrorist attacks are on the increase. So what are these Western powers really doing on the ground in Africa?
Clearly, U.S. and French policies are actually making the problem worse and causing it to spread farther and farther. And the fact that the U.S. military has a presence in, I think, 53 of 55 countries is outrageous. The U.S. has no idea what it's doing. It's inserting itself in areas about which it's completely ignorant, and the only result can be to aggravate local conflicts. That is quite true. And wherever the U.S. goes, military conflict goes, and military quagmires arise. It's a case of these empires just flailing about aimlessly and making conditions worse by their very presence. And in the case of Mali, I mean, the original sin was the overthrow of Gaddafi in Libya, and the overthrow of Gaddafi in Libya, and the fact that Libya then subsided into anarchy, meant that arms were liberated from the government. They spread across the country. They were sold internationally, and huge amounts of arms made their way to the south, to countries like Mali. They had a huge destabilizing impact. So wherever the U.S. or the Western powers intervene, the result is to create more disorder rather than less. The upshot is widening conflict, more deaths, more destruction, and more anarchy. So that's the situation that France finds itself in.
Mr. Lazard there says that foreign military presence has worsened the situation in African countries. Of course, amid the mess, these Western powers are looting the continent's resources. Well, that's our next topic. After a short break, we shall see how Canadian multinationals are looting mineral resources in Africa. Stay with us.
Canada stealing Africa's minerals.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The Canadian mining industry is a global giant. Around 75% of mining companies are based in Canada. Now, currently, Canada-based companies own majority shares in two of the three largest gold mines in the African continent, the Loulo-Gounkoto mine in Mali and Kibali in the Democratic Republic of Congo, are owned almost entirely by Canada's Barrick Gold Corporation. The majority of internationally listed mining companies are also headquartered in Canada, and these companies have operations in almost every African country.
These companies have largely been responsible for dispossessing farmers, displacing communities, employing forced labor, devastating ecosystems, and sparing human rights violations. And in addition to this, these companies are infamous for evading taxes. In 2019, minutes before Barrick Gold's annual general meeting, a spontaneous flash mob emerged to protest over violations by this Canadian mining giant in the Dominican Republic, Papua New Guinea, and Tanzania.
The world is almost every country in the world.
Here people do not have access.
Here people do not have access
to clean water.
To clean water.
Barrick mine sites.
Barrick mine sites.
In PNG and Tanzania.
In PNG.
Now, to discuss more about the negative impact of Canadian mining companies in Africa, we have contacted Edward Corrigan, an international human rights lawyer. Now, we first wanted to know why many internationally listed mining companies looting African resources are headquartered in Canada.
About 75% of the world's mining companies are actually headquartered in Canada. Canada has a very strong mining sector and also has a lot of resources for to be extracted, gold, even diamonds, oil, and many other things, copper, nickel. So it's in a very, very strong position to develop the expertise and has the resources to expand out in the world, particularly to Africa, but also to Latin America.
Africa's mineral resources, which are public resources for everyone's benefit, are being privatized by Canadian mining multinationals. Canada is actually looting the African continent and destroying the environment while hoodwinking the public that these are genuine investment moves. How are Canadian mining companies involved in looting African mineral resources?
The way the economy is structured, particularly for shareholders, and it's sort of a, you know, all economic systems have strengths and weaknesses, but the weaknesses in the capitalist system, and particularly the stock market, is that the people want to get maximum return on their investment, but they're not directly connected to the results of their investment or the actions of the company. So the shareholders want maximum return, therefore the people that they hire and put in charge of these companies want to keep their jobs, and they want to make as much money as possible, so they're ruthless and make deals and don't want to pay taxes. They don't want to cover the external costs. For example, damage to the environment, damage to human rights, damage to, you know, agricultural sector. So by externalizing the cost, they make a lot more money, but of course the costs are still there and should be calculated as part of the overall operation. But in most third world countries, they're ignored. They're just dumped on the people, and you have corrupt elites, you know, in the military or the government or private sector that are quite willing to sell out their own country and trample on the rights of indigenous people or other poor people in their countries and take the money for themselves.
The Canadian government abets this exploitation by encouraging investment development efforts in Africa through initiatives such as the Canadian Investment Fund for Africa, which preaches privatization of businesses and other services, industrial development, and mineral prospection and exploration. Is the Canadian government complicit in the looting of African minerals by mining companies based in the country?
Well, unfortunately, the Canadian government is complicit in that they, directly represent in external affairs, tries to promote these mining industries in the third world because the companies are based in Canada, they pay taxes there, they lobby the Canadian government, they are in a position to exert power on the Canadian government and affect, democratic elections in Canada. But those same things don't apply in third world countries. So you have the Canadian government, intervening on behalf of these mining corporations to, for example, stop the, Mexico from taxing their mining operations. Same thing in Africa, where you have, actually horrific instances, assassination of political leaders, assassination of indigenous leaders, attacks on people who are trying to protect the environment. And because of the political system in Canada, the corporations pay money to the Canadian government, and then they want the representation. So the Canadian government, which supposedly has a good reputation, then intercedes and puts pressure on the governments to bow to the corporations that are based in Canada.
Canada's resolve to continue control of Africa's mining sector was a major objective of the recent Canada-Africa Chamber of Business, which was addressed by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. The conference was attended by major Canadian companies involved in Africa's lucrative mining sector. Now, how have African leaders abated the wanton looting of the continent's resources by Canadian companies?
In a word, corruption. The most countries in Africa and even Latin America and South America, you've got very corrupt elites. You've got very strong presence of military. You've got dictatorships, and these individuals will take money for themselves, sell out their communities, and sell out their own countries, and make themselves rich. But the money, again, doesn't go to the country. Most of the time it goes up to some sort of tax shelter or hidden away in Switzerland or some other country that has tight banking rules that allows people to hide their wealth. So you have people with, a job that only pays maybe $5,000 or $10,000 a year, but they end up being, multimillionaires because of the corruption and the payments they get and how they use the police and death squads and, private militias to suppress people who are directly affected.
Canada's premium nickel resources is set to buy Botswana's defunct state-owned BCL copper mine with a view to restarting operations within 3 years. This is yet another example of how Canadian multinationals are conspiring to take over major African mining operations to the detriment of the continent. While these Western multinationals take away gold in Africa, locals, including children, desperate to survive, are forced to engage in primitive mining, which is risky for their lives.
Now, the issue of the looting of African resources by Western countries is a never-ending challenge. So what needs to be done to end this looting?
Well, it's a very good question. There needs to be, I think, some international laws setting, minimum levels of taxation. You need to strengthen the United Nations. You need to strengthen, the international court system and justice system and allow people to sue companies in Canada or the United States or wherever they're based which was at least, I think, one way to solve the problem. But the companies need to realize that by exploiting these countries and resources in a very, very detrimental way to the local people, in the long term, it's not in their interest, because eventually there'll be some pushback and problems. And it'd be, in my opinion, it's much better if the companies work in a positive way, so that the countries who have the resources get the benefit of the resources.
Well, thanks a lot, Mr. Corrigan, for your insight. Here at Africa Today, we shall continue exposing the continued looting of Africa's resources by Western multinationals. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. Send us your views and comments through our social media handle. From me, Mubarak Kenya, it's goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. I am your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be looking at a very important question, and that is a question that is often brought up by non-Muslims and as an objection towards Islam, and that is the question about, is Islam a violent religion or not? This question you know, it leads to a second question, and that is that if somebody answers in the positive, right, people will say, well, a religion shouldn't be violent. Religion should be peaceful, right? If it wants to, if we want to, you know, religion, the purpose of religion is to bring people closer to God, and we can become closer to God, you know, in such turbulence by being violent, right? Rather, we have to be closer to God. We have to sit in the corner of our house or our church or the temple and contemplate God and think about Him and try to achieve some sort of peace with Him. And how could one do that when one is, for example, fighting jihad against somebody else or in a battle? I'd like to answer this question by referencing a tradition and a hadith regarding one of the battles in which Imam Ali was present in. In one of the battles in which Imam Ali participated in, following the demise of the Prophet, in the thick of the battle, in the very heat of the battle, Imam Ali paused for a moment. He came to his tent and he rested. He was surrounded by his companions. In this time, a Bedouin came to Imam Ali and asked Imam Ali a question, a theological question regarding God and predestination. He said, he asked Imam Ali, he said, are we here because in this battle, are we fighting here in this battle because we have been predestined to or not? Now, when this Bedouin asked Imam Ali alayhi salam this question, the companions of Imam Ali who were surrounding him, they became upset and said, can't you see that the Imam, the commander of the faithful, is preoccupied with much more important things right now than what you are asking him about? When Imam Ali heard his companions scold the Bedouin in this way, the Imam became quite upset and said, let him ask his question, because, and this is very important, he said, the whole reason why we are here in this battle and fighting with the people we are fighting is because of this very purpose, right? It's because of this very purpose. In other words, if we're fighting these people, if we are in this battle and we're waging this war against these uncouths and these criminals, it is because we want people to become closer to God. We want them to achieve this proximity to God, achieve this knowledge and this awareness and this cognition of these matters that this Bedouin is asking us about. This shows us that, right, it is this hadith is very beautiful in the sense that not only does it show us that it's possible, even in these such situations, where in such violent situations, to still achieve this proximity to God, but actually the whole purpose of this and the function of this of jihad and war and battle in Islam is this proximity that we want to achieve to God. Thank you for joining us here today on The Key. We were examining Islam and violence. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
It's hardly more than a few years since Mohammed bin Salman rose as the crown prince and the de facto leader of the Saudi kingdom. Yet over this rather short period of time, he has damaged his reputation as a young prince who's seeking to bring the whole kingdom under the yoke of his servitude, while shocking the world with his callous disregard for human life. Arresting other princes, influential people, and rights activists, waging a bloody war on the poor Yemeni civilians, and bringing about a host of other plights such as famine and diseases for them, killing his opponents, exemplified in the case of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, are all just a few instances that show bin Salman is prepared to do any crime to make sure that he will have easy accession to the throne. Yet there are some cases that keep the Saudi prince up at night, like the case of Saad al-Jabri, a former top Saudi intelligence officer now living in exile in Canada. After his interview with 60 Minutes on CBS News, al-Jabri once again hit the headlines. The aim was to pressure bin Salman into releasing his son Omar and daughter Sarah, reportedly detained in an attempt to force him back to the kingdom. "I have to speak out. I'm appealing to the American people and to the American administration to help me release those children and to restore their life." In the interview, the former spy master sent threatening signals to Riyadh that he could be a whistleblower if push comes to shove. Al-Jabri said bin Salman boasted in 2014 that he could kill King Abdullah using a poisoned ring he had acquired from Russia. In less than a year, King Abdullah died, and his half-brother Salman was crowned king. Al-Jabri had already accused bin Salman of an attempt on his life because he knows damaging secrets about how the prince was catapulted to power. Al-Jabri says the Saudi crown prince has no empathy and considers him as a person who poses a threat to his people, to the Americans, and to the planet.
Essentially, Mohammed bin Salman came to power under his father as part of a coup. It was a coup that he had initiated. And you'll remember that some of the most important members of the royal family were arrested and detained at the, whatever it was, the Four Seasons Hotel, I think it was. Many of them were stripped of billions of dollars of wealth. They were accused of crimes, including corruption. Some died mysteriously in plane crashes. One was shot down on the border with Yemen. I think these are the secrets. The secrets are that this young man didn't think twice about murdering members of his own family to take power.
In one of his key lawsuits filed in August 2019 against bin Salman, the former intelligence officer said the prince sent the hit team that murdered Khashoggi to Canada to kill him, but were intercepted and deported at Ottawa's International Airport.
We have reports that Khashoggi was screaming in agony as they were chopping him up while he was still alive. And why? Because he supported human rights, and he maybe could be seen as an opponent of Mohammed bin Salman. He had never done anything. He had never fomented a coup attempt. He didn't write columns in the Washington Post in opposition to the Crown Prince.